Nominally an organizer of this event, I'd like to thank the people who actually did the organizing and also for inviting me to be part of it. So I would like to introduce you all to the subject area where I'm working on, categorical quantum theory. And maybe I should start by saying a little bit about why this is an interesting topic for me. So I, unlike most of you, I'm a computer scientist rather than a physicist. So my motivations are coming from looking at quantum computing. And so I suppose everyone here knows, it doesn't need to be told, that the idea of quantum computing is to exploit quantum effects to do computational things. And there's many interesting computational things you can do if you do that. And so one of the questions we'd like to know is why. So we think about classical computers. We know that underneath, they may be made out of circuits, they may have lots of bits flying around, but in fact, there's this nice logical algebraic structure, the theory of functions, which is actually what's making the computation, in some sense, understandable and making it all work. And so we see this in functional programming languages, we see this in the lambda calculus, and basically, the underlying structure here is a categorical one, namely Cartesian closed categories. Okay, so if we go to the world of quantum computing, we know that we have all these complicated bits of apparatus, we have these relatively low-level bits of mathematics, which I'm going to kind of equate to these strings of bits up here. And my question is, what is the right higher algebraic structure to go here? So we have a couple of clues of what it might be, and two of the most basic ones are the no cloning and no deleting theorems, which says that if I have two non-orthogonal quantum states, there's no quantum operation that can copy both of them. Likewise, no pair of non-orthogonal quantum states can be uniformly erased by a quantum operation. So this is definitely telling us that we are not in the world of Cartesian categories, right? So what we're going to attempt to do is to formalize as much of finite dimensional quantum theory as we need to do quantum computing without reference, without being in a Cartesian setting, and particularly without reference to the fact that we're in a linear space at all. So I like to do everything in this as an internal theory in some monoidal category. Okay, so that basically means I'm going to have some algebras, some coalgebras, and certain laws for their interaction. And I'm not going to assume anything else at all. So I think it was on Monday, Michael Milgaard gave the talk. So I'm working in tensor category, oh, but also it's a C-linear category. So we're not going to make any such assumptions here. Okay. And so what it's going to turn out to be is, unlike these nice textual things, because we're working in a monoidal setting, a tensor category, the really appropriate structure is going to be two-dimensional. So we're going to see a lot of diagrams of this kind. And I'll talk a reasonable length about why we should do that. So here's the general kind of schema of the whole thing. We have actual quantum theory, which we abstract into categorical quantum theory, which is a theory about monoidal categories, coalgebras and algebras, and commutation rules. And we'd like to go even a little bit further than this and try to understand what are all the possible quantum theories. And by this, I mean thinking of all this stuff, not so much as a bunch of ad hocery, but as an algebraic theory in the sense of universal algebra. And so we'll be looking at props and distributive laws between props and thinking of any kind of algebra for these given props as being a candidate quantum theory. And at every step, actual quantum theory better be an example. Right? Okay, so this is quite a big area now. So there's lots of things that I won't talk about that one can do in this setting. So there'll be no mixed states, probability, CP maps. There'll be no discussion of causality. There'll be no discussion of contextuality or non-locality or infinite dimensional spaces. But people have worked in all these topics. And these are some of the earlier papers who address these things. And they've all been developed much further since then. OK. So we're going to be very abstract soon, so I thought I'd start by being very concrete. And the first thing I want to say is I'm not going to talk about all those things. I'm going to focus on observables. And for me, an observable is a very simple thing. I'm talking about non-degenerate projective observables on a finite dimensional space, i.e. an orthonormal basis for the space. So if my observable is called A, then I'll just call the basis k(a1, a2, up to whatever. OK. So let's define some terms. So I'm going to call an arbitrary state unbiased for a basis if for every element of the basis, the inner product between the state and the basis element is in magnitude the same, right? And it has to be the square root of the dimension. And if you give me such an unbiased state, I can use it to define a unitary map, U of psi, which just sends each basis vector to the same basis vector multiplied by that inner product, which will be a unit normalized to be the right size. Okay, so given a basis A, the collection of all such unitaries I call the phases. And so U psi is a phase map for A. Okay, so it's not difficult to see that the phase maps are an abelian group. And if we can go a little bit to a concrete example of a qubit, if I pick this particular basis, the computational basis, then the collection of unbiased points are those that sit on the equator of this block sphere. So they're equidistant between both basis elements. And looking at the shape of this state here, you can see that the corresponding maps will be all the z rotations. Okay. All right, so I don't want to think about only one observable, I want to think about two observables. And so we'll say they're complementary or mutually unbiased if each basis vector is unbiased for each vector of the other basis. Okay? And we'll say that they are strongly complementary, and this is my main concept for the day, if the phase group of one, the collection of phase maps generated by one basis is actually a subgroup of the phase group of the other one. Okay, so it's automatically contained in the phase group, but it's not automatically a subgroup, right? Okay, and then what we know, looking again at concrete things, if we have observables of the sense I've defined earlier, they're in bijection with Dagger special commutative Frobenius algebras. So all these words will be defined in due course, but we're looking at a coalgebra and an algebra, and the way that you obtain the particular ones we're looking at is you take your basis and you send each basis vector to two copies of itself for the co-multiplication, and you map each basis vector onto the scalar 1 for the co-unit, and the multiplication and unit are just obtained by the Hermitian adjoint. Okay, so every one of these particular Frobenius algebras is generated by maps of this kind for some basis. And it's obvious that for every basis we can write down such maps. Okay, so the interesting theorem.
Sorry, so that's a basis dependent definition.
Yes, yes.
And that's why you get the vector.
Yeah. Okay, so if I have two such things, so I've got my four operations, and I'm using different colors to denote the different bases. So all the green things are one basis, all the red things are the other basis. So since they're bases, I can bracket them this way, and this will be Frobenius, and this will be Frobenius. And the theorem says if they're strongly complementary, and I bracket them this way, they form Hopf algebras. Okay? So I have, again, co-multiply, co-unit, multiply, unit. Okay, and the classic example of this is just group algebras, right? So I'm looking at the basis vectors of 0 up to d as being the group elements Zd. Okay, and then we can quite simply prove in this setup, if I'm talking about complex Hilbert spaces, all the strongly complementary pairs are group algebras of some abelian group or another. Right. So that is the kind of theory of observables that we're interested in. It might not seem very interesting so far, but you will be amazed to see how much of the things that people in quantum computing actually calculate you can do just from these facts. Okay, so let's become a bit more abstract. So the definition of monoidal category, if you look in Maclean, it occupies two pages. We're going to talk about strict monoidal categories. It's our first simplification, so we can forget about all this part. But I don't want to do this. As I said earlier, I want to do everything in diagrams, right? So let's do it again, but graphically. So as I said earlier, I'm not a physicist, so I'm using what I consider the natural convention for drawing diagrams, also the pessimistic convention. So we start at the top and we read downwards. Okay, so why would we want to do diagrams? Quick tester. What's this? No, easier question. Is that even well defined? Nobody can see it? Okay, let's move on. So, this is the kind of diagrams I'm interested in. Thinking of morphisms in a monoidal category. So I have some number of systems coming in, I have some number of systems coming out, and in between I have some interaction, or a process, or a change of state, or whatever. Okay, so my pictures will all look vaguely like this, and since we're in a category, I can join these things together. So given some elements, F, G, H, I could compose them sequentially, as you can with morphisms in a category. I can compose them in parallel, since we're in a monoidal category. Okay, these are my two constructions. Since I'm in a category, I have identity morphisms for every object. So I just write them as a bare wire. And I know that if I compose the identity with something, it's the same thing as composing it the other way around with the identity, and the same thing as do nothing. So the first sort of lemma is the length of the wires doesn't matter. Second, I know the composition is associative, so that diagram is unambiguous. Since I'm in a strict monoidal category, tensor is also associative, so that diagram is unambiguous. And because I have the interchange law, that diagram is also unambiguous. And this is your greatest win for using diagrammatic notation instead of the usual notation, because I can just see what's next to each other in two-dimensional setting instead of having to greatly re-bracket some potentially very long expression. Okay. I have a unit for the tensor product, which I will denote by the empty diagram or the no wire. And so if I have states or points, i.e. morphisms out of the unit, I just draw them like this with no incoming wire. And dually, if I have copoints or effects, I draw them with an incoming wire and nothing coming out. And evidently, I can have morphisms of this type, which we call scalars. And so if you tilt your head, this is Dirac's notation, right? So this is indeed the scalar product of this state with this effect. Okay, I want to have a symmetry map, so just a symmetry, no braiding here. So I'm going to cross the wires. If I cross them twice, that cancels. And the fact that it's natural means that my morphisms can slide through the intersection. Okay, so again, the position of the boxes on the wires doesn't matter, even if the wires cross. And the second to last bit of structure I'm going to have is compact structure in this category. So this equation appeared earlier in the week, and I forget whose talk. It was called rigid category. So if we're already in a symmetric setting, then this is usually called compact. So it's called compact if I have a dual object and a morphism of this type, and I'm indicating which one's the dual and which one's the original by direction of the arrow. And I have this co-unit as well. And they have to satisfy the equation that says if I compose them like that, then that's the identity and the obvious dualized version. So the moral of this story is the location of the wire in the plane is unimportant also. They can bend freely. Okay, and the last thing, because I want to talk about quantum mechanics, I want to be able to talk about unitarity and self-adjointness. So I'm going to bring in this dagger functor. So a dagger category is any category equipped with a dagger functor. What does it do? It's involutive, it's contravariant, and it's the identity on objects. Okay, so with this available to me, I can define what it means to be unitary. So anything, any morphism is unitary if it's invertible, and its inverse is its dagger, and it's self-adjoint if it's equal to its dagger. And a dagger functor between dagger categories is one that preserves a dagger on the nose. And if we ask for a symmetric monoidal category to be dagger, we want all the structure maps, which for us is just the swap, to be unitary in the sense above. Okay. And in my diagrammatic notation, I'm going to represent the dagger by flipping the picture. Right? So I'm indicated corner here, and I've indicated the opposite corner here. This is F from A to B. This is F dagger from B to A. All right? And I can do this to the entire diagram all at once because it's a monoidal functor. It commutes with everything. Okay. And this is just unitary if it annihilates with its adjoint on both sides. Okay. So what are some examples of Dagger categories? Most importantly, finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. So the Dagger is just the Hermitian adjoint. Category of sets and relations. Dagger is relational converse. Any groupoid is a Dagger category in an obvious way. Any category of spans is a Dagger category in an obvious way. Ditto cospans. And if I have any category which is the co-product of something and its opposite, that's also a Dagger category in the obvious way of just taking everything in here, every morphism here, to be the Dagger of everything in there. Okay. The obvious detail we will come to later if you haven't already seen it. Okay, if we put together all these facts, we get the most important theorem, which says that if the two diagrams are deformable to each other, then they are equal according to the equations of the categorical theories we've just discussed. Right? And so this is essentially a pile of different theorems by different people at different times, and they're all gathered together in this survey paper by Peter Selinger. But the upshot is, if it looks the same, it is the same. Even if it doesn't look that similar, it might still be the same. Okay. Right. So our favorite example is the category of finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. I probably don't need to spend any time on this, do I? Okay. So that is a kind of axiomatization or a kind of picking out of the structure that we find in the category that we're interested in. But I would like to be much more abstract than that and have the minimum possible amount of structure in order to do my quantum theory. And so we're going to talk a little bit about props. Okay, so if you haven't read it, this is a wonderful paper and you should read it. And most of what I'm going to say comes from this paper. All right. Okay, so what's a prop, or rather, what's a pro? Let's start with that. So a pro is a strict monoidal category, so far so good, and the objects are the natural numbers. In other words, there is one object which generates all the others by tensor product. Right? So an algebra for a pro is just a strict monoidal functor to some other monoidal category, and therefore a morphism of pros is an algebra, which is the identity on objects, because we want to preserve the structure of being a pro. Okay, so we can then form these things all into a category, which I call pro. Prop, so pro stands for products, and P stands for permutations, is just a symmetric pro. Okay, so now we have the possibility to cross wires. So we can see that it's a subcategory among the pros. So an example of great interest for us of a prop is the subcategory of F.D. Hilb generated by the qubit, right? So I take every morphism between some register of qubits, well, between two registers of qubits. A more basic one is to let this thing P be the pro of permutations. So the endomorphisms between N and N will be the whole symmetric group, and if M and N are different, there are no morphisms. Okay, so that is, in fact, the initial prop. Okay, so since every prop contains the permutations in this sense, you can think of the category of props as being this co-slice. So I've got the permutations embedded into props. And therefore, if I want to form the disjoint union in prop, I have to have only one copy of the permutations, and therefore I do this disjoint union by the pushout. Yep. And so this is the same detail you need to do to make a Dagger category out of C and C op. We have to have only one copy of the objects. Yep. Okay. So we can present props syntactically. So we have some collection of generators, which will be some abstract symbols with arities and inputs and outputs, and some collection of equations between them. And if we present the prop this way, then the disjoint union is super simple. Take the disjoint union of the symbols and the disjoint union of the equations. Okay. So that's not so interesting, right? Just taking disjoint unions. What we'd like to do is for our structures to interact. And this is where the idea of composing props comes in. So if you read through Lack's paper, you'll find out that props are monads in a certain category. It's all a little bit complicated, but monads have distribution laws and props are therefore the same. And so what we need to do, if we want to distribute T over S, then it boils down to for every composable pair of a morphism from T and a morphism from S, finding a pair S prime, T prime, such that they compose in the other way. Okay, and then this will be an equation from this composite to this composite. Right? So given such a distributive law, I have now this new set of equations that I can simply just throw in to my co-product of props. Okay. Or equivalently, just take the quotient of the co-product. So let's think of a very simple one. I'll take all the n-fold copies of some given group. So I'm writing gx to be however many copies of the group in product. And I'll take my initial prop P. So that can be thought of as being generated just by the swap subject to C squared is the identity and the Young-Baxter equation. And then I can perform the following distribution, saying if I have G1 and G2 followed by swap, I can push them through and swap them. The obvious rule. Okay. And then I have this composite prop, which means I'll have some permutation followed by an n vector of group elements. Okay, so far, so good. Just for the sake of remarking, these are both groupoids, so they're both Dagger categories, so the composite is also a Dagger category. Because it's of this form, because you get it from a distributive law, it's of the form something plus something else. Okay. Furthermore, this gives us a functor from the category of groups into the category of props, just by this construction we showed. So a slightly more interesting example is the prop of commutative monoids. So every time I say monoid, I mean commutative monoid. And every time I say comonoid, I mean co-commutative monoid. So I have two symbols, which I'm going to now draw graphically. And I have three equations. The equation that says they're associative, the equation that says they're unital, and the equation that says it's commutative. And so every algebra of this prop is a monoid in whatever category we go to. Ditto for co-commutative comonoids, it's just the opposite category. So the opposite generators and the opposite equations. So the prop of bi-algebras then arises by distributive law of monoids over comonoids. Right, so I have my equations oriented this way around. So here's a multiply followed by co-multiply. I rewrite it to this thing the other way around. And these are all the bi-algebra equations we're familiar with. And so that composite prop turns out to be spans of finite sets. And the prop of special commutative Frobenius algebras, so our key example, is again a distributive law, but this time comonoids over monoids. So these are the Frobenius algebra equations I expect everyone has seen before, familiar from TQFTs. And the thing that makes them special is this one, which says that we can throw away the holes. Right? So these things are also called commutative separable algebras by Rosberg and Sabadini-Walters. And so this is now cospans of finite sets. And we'll see this theorem again in a different guise in a few minutes. Okay. So I guess it goes without saying that a Dagger prop is just a prop which is also a symmetric monoidal Dagger category. Okay, and so we might also ask that the algebras preserve the Dagger. So every example we've seen has a natural Dagger structure. Right. Okay, so let's go a little bit more onto Frobenius algebra, since this is how we're going to formalize quantum observables. Okay, so we just saw this slide a second ago. So here's the usual definition of these two equations. And this fact that it's equivalent to cospan of finset means that we actually have a nice normal form. So whenever I've got a connected diagram in this diagrammatic language, it's equivalent to a tree of this shape, or a tree composed with a co-tree, which means I can simply define my syntax differently with what we call the spiders. Right? So I have n legs at the top, m legs at the bottom. Any connected diagram with n legs and m legs is equal to this one. And the corollary of that is that the prop of Frobenius algebras, and I'm going to stop saying Dagger special commutative, I just say Frobenius algebras, it's compact and it's self-dual. So there's only one object, so it has to be its own dual. And you can see this by thinking of composing the 0 to 2-legged thing with the 2 to 0-legged thing, and that must be the identity. So since it is compact, we can define transpose by wrapping any other morphism in a suitable cup and cap. And we can define the conjugate by applying the dagger to this entire thing. And you can prove quite easily that the dagger commutes with the transpose. So this allows us to define what it means to be real with respect to a given Frobenius algebra. And you want to think back into the concrete world with respect to a given basis. Okay. So this lower green dot is the conjugate, and the upper green dot is the transpose. Okay. And so in the prop F, everything in sight is real because it's just a consequence of the spider theorem. Okay, but in the algebras of the prop, that might not be true. Okay, so I want to think now into algebras of this prop for a minute. So if I have some map from the object to the object, and it commutes like this, so I have it only on one side of the multiplication, then I call this a prephase, and it's a phase of its unitary. Right? And similarly, if I have any old point, then I'll call the point unbiased if the left action it gives rise to is a phase. Okay, so obviously anything of this shape will obey this commutation property because this is a commutative associative algebra. Okay, so the key point is if that is unitary, then this is unbiased. So this is me basically restating the definition I gave at the beginning in terms of this algebra structure. And then you have some nice facts, which I will just skip over in the interest of time. But the summary is we can prove from what we've seen so far, the phases are an abelian group, the unbiased points are an abelian group, and they're both isomorphic. So we can use this to make, again, this prop G. And then we can add some equations for the relations between G cross and F, like so. As you expect, commutes past the multiplication this way, commutes past the co-multiplication that way. And so this gives rise to what they call an iterative distributive law. Because F itself was composite, I can now factor everything in my new prop as a multiplication followed by some group elements followed by a co-multiplication. So this thing that I'm calling FG is now the prop of Frobenius algebras with phases. So this is what we characterized observables as earlier. Okay, and again, that gives a functor from groups to dagger props. I'm writing abelian group here, but if you could just put a non-abelian group, you'll get its abelianization on the other side. Okay, so at the moment, we've only kind of considered what it means to have a theory with one observable. So we should, Yes, so a way of restating this factorization result is as a generalized spider theorem. So I have some connected diagram where some phases or unbiased points occur. I can, again, swallow them all up into one spider. The graph structure is just given by the number of ins and outs, and the label in the center is just the sum of all the labels in the other thing. Okay. So one observable is not a greatly interesting theory. Let's bring two. So the first thing to do is to form the co-product of two different Frobenius observables. So we get this kind of alternating sequence of things as the factorization. And if we zoom in a little bit, we can see that each of these blocks really has this kind of bow tie shape. And the fact that there's no interactions between them means that if I have anything which is unitary in this setup, it means that it was actually just a permutation labeled by group elements. Okay? And if something is real in both colors, then it must just have been a permutation as well. But if we look a bit closer, we see that now we have composites of this form, right? So the bialgebraic shape in the middle. Okay, so we could start by trying to impose the axioms of the bialgebra onto this framework. So here are the axioms we saw earlier, except now I'm drawing the monoid in red and the comonoid in green. And these are the usual axioms. And if I want to make it a Hopf algebra, I bring in my antipode, and I have this additional equation. Okay, but the problem here is that this one is just not true. Due to the normalization that we've chosen, this will be the square root of the dimension, right? So we're going to give up this equation and weaken our axioms to something that looks more like this. That's what I'm calling a scaled bialgebra. And all that means is that I have my usual equations, but I'm picking up whatever scalar factor it is I need to make them actually come out equal in my model. Okay. So this one we don't have. And using this stuff, because I know that they're Frobenius algebras, I can now define the antipode as this combination of a cup and a cap from the two different Frobenius algebras. And then the resulting four-tuple is a Hopf algebra, if and only if we have these properties. So saying that the green unit is red real, and the red co-unit is green real. Everything is dagger, so you can exchange co and no co as you wish. Okay, so this is the set of axioms then that we adopt to formalize what it means to be a Frobenius-Hopf algebra. Worth noting that these things are equivalent to saying that the co-unit commutes with the antipode, or the unit commutes with the antipode. But we don't have a full distributive law because there are certain parts of the structure which don't interact. Like the red comonoid doesn't interact with the green comonoid, and so on. Okay, so then now I have a functor from two copies of the abelian groups into props, so I can make some kind of complementary observables for any pair of groups that I want. And this will be, in some ways, some version of quantum theory. So one can develop quite a lot more structure of this, and I'm not going to do that now, but I want to bring one last thing into play, what we call classical structure. So I guess everyone knows I call an element set-like if it's copied by the co-multiplication. Okay, and we know that the set-like elements are always forming an abelian group, and as a consequence of my earlier definitions, if I have some set-like elements with a green structure, which are also unbiased for the red structure, this means they must be a phase subgroup of the phase group. So this is my definition from earlier. Okay, and we can prove a couple of lemmas, saying that if it's a set-like element, then it can't be unbiased, and if it's unbiased for the other color, then it must be real. So we can kind of categorize all the points in our theory into two lots, the set-like ones, so ones which are copied, and I showed you the scalar factors earlier, I'm not going to show them anymore, just put them back in mentally. And we have the unbiased points. Okay, and the unbiased points is saying that this should be unitary, right? A priori, we only have one unbiased point, the unit, and possibly no set-like elements. But if we have some, we can prove some nice properties of them. For example, if I have one of my phase maps of one color, one of my set-like elements for the other color, then I can break things up like this. And due to my copying rule, I can see that there are eigenvectors of all those phase groups. Likewise, if I have the map generated by a classical point, it will commute with the comonoid structure. And from that, I can derive the classical commutation relations. Sorry, the canonical commutation relations. Okay. So in my free theory, I don't necessarily have any. So I'll pick myself a subgroup from each of my two phase groups and just impose an additional equation that those subgroup members will be set like. Okay. Okay, so if I have a classical map in this sense, it's automatically a coalgebra morphism, and you obtain its dagger by conjugating with the antipode. And more interestingly, for every phase map, I can produce another phase map by conjugating with one of these classical maps. So by asking for more equations, I created a lot more unitaries. Okay, so these things play quite an important role in the rest of the story, but I'll leave it for now. And well, the most important part is it gives me an action of my group of classical points on my phase group, and constructed like this. Yep.
And in your definition of classical elements, you just require a copy condition?
Yeah.
You didn't require any of the other, like you didn't require conjugation or deletion by the field.
What was the second thing you said?
You don't have, for example, in Hilbert, that definition allows zero to be a classical element.
Ah, right.
So you would need a conjugation axiom to turn it around, for example, and a deletion axiom to avoid the zero. Otherwise, you don't get a problem. Even in Hilbert, copy is not enough, because you still have zero. But in general, even copy and deletion is not enough.
Okay, I'll check back with you. I think we might get these things properties. But
yeah.
I need to check. Okay, so this is all very abstract. So what we actually want this for is to do quantum computing, which means we're going to pick specific examples. Right. So this is a theory called the ZX calculus, which is an example of the family of theories I've just shown you. So we pick two observables, the Pauli Z and Pauli X. They are strongly complementary. Their respective phase groups are just the circle. Since we're two-dimensional, I only have two classical points. My underlying Hopf-algebra is the group is Z2. And the action of Z2 on the circle is to send every angle to its negation. Okay. And the more important part is the following, that I only get one transposition operation in this family because these two things are both real at the same time, which means I can identify them and just have one cup and one cap. And because of this, I can now just treat my whole diagram as an undirected graph. And the diagram theorem says now that if they're isomorphic as graphs, they're equal as elements of the category. And the last slightly ad hoc thing is that my two colors are related by unitary, so I have a color change rule. So I will throw this axiom in as a bonus. So the good things about this theory is that it's universal. Everything in quantum mechanics has a term that denotes it. It has nice algebra, which we've just seen. It's all about Hopf algebras. You can represent almost anything you can think of. And the only bad point is the operational meaning of these ZX terms is a little unclear. This point is now false because some people have recently added some additional axioms which makes this theory complete with a Clifford plus T fragment. So by complete, I mean everything which is true in the model being the subtheory of quantum mechanics generated by Clifford and T, then you can prove it in the diagrammatic notation. And even more recently, some other people proved it for the whole of the unitary groups. So every true fact about matrices over qubit matrices can now be proved in this formalism. So I'm not going to show you the axioms because they're kind of ad hoc and a bit ugly and unstable. You can see how recent this is. So in a year's time, I expect this will be much better. So we'll look at the basic version very quickly. Okay, so our syntax will now be graphs of two kinds of vertices, Z vertices, X vertices. Any graph is a term. We do the semantics, thinking of them as linear maps. So I have n qubits on the top, m qubits on the bottom, and these are the corresponding maps. I'm just defining them on basis elements. So I can write down my standard qubits. I can write down the plus and minus. I can write down my Paulis. Rotations look like this. The C0 gate can be written one of two ways, but again, these are equal because they're the same graph. And the theorem says that for every unitary map, I can write it down as ZX term by basically translating this universal gate set into my language. Okay.
On that last slide, the previous one that you just had, that last string diagram.
This?
Yeah, what does that mean?
It means either of them, they're the same. Yeah. And so I take the spiders as the generators. So I don't have the equations of Frobenius things, I just have the rules for the compose spiders. I have the equations from the hop structure. Note this is a Z2 hop algebra, so the antipode is trivial. This is the conjugation of the non-trivial classical element with the other phases. And this is my color change rule. This is kind of ugly, but what it basically boils down to is recognizing that the usual Hadamard matrix, which is the Fourier transform of C2, is written like this in its Euler decomposition. So if you use this, I'll just define it like that, and then you can apply the color change rule to show that red and green are the same. Okay. So we can prove some nice circuit identity. So 3 C naughts in a row should be the swap. Is it true? Yes, there's the proof. You can see what we're using here. We're using here to here the fact that we have a hop. Sorry, here we're using the fact that we have a bi-algebra, and here we're using the fact that it's a hop algebra. And here as well. We can simulate the quantum Fourier transform. So I'll just bash through this very quickly. So this is all consequences of the equations that I showed you. It doesn't know anything about quantum mechanics. It only knows about hop algebras. And that's the Fourier transform. More seriously, we can think about MBQC. So think of any graph state, so a tensor network generated by coupling spins together. So we can form it up in a graph of this shape. If it's too colorable, it will be too colorable. And we can use the fact that we have these normal forms for hop algebras to do useful things. So usually we think I'm going to transform something messy into something nice. But in MBQC, I often have things which start off nice but don't have good computational properties. So I can take advantage of the fact that I have this normal form to replace this normal thing with something which has a nice sequentiality property that lets me run a deterministic computation on this graph. So I can prove that my complicated MBQC program was equivalent to its specification. And I can prove also the correctness of error correcting codes. And if the chair will allow me, I will do a quick demo. So the nice thing about phrasing all these equations as graphs is that you can reason by graph rewriting. And graph rewriting is not that difficult to automate. So what you see in this is a program called Quantumatic. And what you see here is a very simple case. This left half is the encoding circuit for a certain quantum error detecting code. This right half is the decoding circuit. And I would like to prove that that encoding and then decoding is a no-op. So this program knows, you can't really read that, can you? This program knows about a lot of the axioms, so they're all named here. And this is a very short routine that just says which order to apply them in. Right. So if I run this program on my graph, so let's zoom out a little. So that's the name of the program. And fingers crossed, it will by itself prove, just using the fact that this is a Z2 hop algebra, that error correcting code works as advertised. I mean, obviously, there's many more properties one should prove, but you can prove them all with slightly more work than that. OK. And with that, I think I'll stop. So let me just point to some references. So this stuff was first developed in this paper from a few years ago. And the kind of props style presentation is from this one. This book recently came out, and it is the best summary of the whole big picture of things in categorical quantum mechanics, rather than the relatively narrow technical stuff that I've showed you today. All right, with that, thanks for your attention.
there were some announcements to make.
Well, sir, by saying that tonight this banquet and it's included in your registration, so it will be covered. So make sure to attend. And I think Courtney has to announce.
Yeah, I mean, just tomorrow night, come down to the pub. It'll be good, like the bistro, at like 6-ish.
On Thursday. That's Thursday.
Tuesday comes.
The second floor bistro, right, I think, and the pub night on the first floor bistro, so it's different. That's informal, that one.
Great. And then let's go for some questions.
You've shown that you can construct an abstract category with a certain specified phase group.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's particularly interesting when it comes to certain abstract quantum algorithms, because the phase group determines
mm-hmm.
kind of things that you can and you cannot do. But of course, that's a problem. And it will be interesting to see which categories with, let's say, linear or probabilistic or quasi-probabilistic structure can be interpreted in that
yep.
way. Do you have any characterization of?
Only the weakest things imaginable. In, like the there's a bound on the dimension of a lower bound of the dimension of the object in the image of the prop of the algebra, depending
yep.
on the size of the phase group. Depending on the size of the classical subgroup.
Yes.
But beyond that, I know very little about what the space of models looks like.
Okay. Any other questions?
So you gave this example with the error correcting code. Does this approach give you any insight into, say, syncrome decoding algorithms? It's a perennial problem for.
I haven't got any particular insight. I mean, we've been able to find syndrome decoding circuits for the error correcting codes we've looked at, but it wasn't through any particularly systematic way.
Along the same lines that error correcting code simplification, that program that you ran, so do you have a proof that it's going to be a confluent system of simplification?
No, and in fact, it's not a confluent rewriting system. So the I showed you this little chunk of program, right? So this is a rewriting strategy, which is guaranteed to terminate in a quasi-normal form. But in general, the system isn't confluent, and for some of the rules, depending how you code them up, it wouldn't even be terminating, right? Because you have commutation rules. So it's not so obvious how to throw in all the axioms and just say, computer, please go at it, because it can easily get stuck. And indeed, the normal forms for this are only quasi-normal, so it might not finish in the one that you want.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I have one. You have shown that you can simplify the circuits, the quantum circuits. Is there any way for doing the offset process? This is that instead of simplifying things, you can systematize a way to implement certain circuits from the known response?
By known response, you mean from its truth table, effectively.
Right. In
that particular example, I can't think of something, but we could do, for example, if you give me the circuit, it's relatively easy to transform it into an MBQC implementation. But the problem is, are you going to do this by hand, or are you going to do it by automation? Because if you are making rules for the graphs to get bigger, then obviously this is not going to determine it.
Any Other questions? All right, I guess then it's time for lunch. Let's thank the speaker.